winter.
Just doing that now because of getting it out of the way with.
Okay.
Do you get, you must get it where it goes, recording in progress as well with the crazy American accent.
Yeah, no, I got that. Yeah, it came through. I was like, okay.
Go on.
Coming from no heat in the UK to Rwanda was, but you quickly get used to it. And it wasn't excessively it wasn't Badlands level.
Yeah.
I was like, when it was hot, I was like, well, it's not Badlands hot. So I played it in my mind. Yeah.
So basically on this edition of the podcast, I have the very lovely Adam in, whereabouts are you? You're somewhere southwest, aren't you?
Worcester, yeah.
Yeah, so we first met during 107 TDF, where we rode together for quite a while. Had a really, really good chat about life and a lot of stuff that was going on with you personally, and then with just me being fucked. and then we did Badlands together, basically. And we ended up riding together quite a lot during that race. Stayed in the same hotel one night when we were both absolutely fucked.
That hotel that I overslept by like 4 hours.
The hotel where you, I mean, it was because it was a bed, wasn't it? That was it.
It was a bed. I didn't set my alarm properly. And I woke up and it was like daylight. And I was like, shit, this should be pitch black. I should be riding the night because I was going to leave before you. And then I was like, oh, it's okay. I'll just get up, get riding, and just see how the day goes. Yeah.
And you did great, finished, you know, you absolutely smashed it the next day or so towards the finish. And you didn't do the wrong turn that I did.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so we ended up riding together quite a lot during that race and chatting a lot as well, which one of the things that I personally really love about these ultra distance things is the people and the conversations you have and the people you meet during the races. I always say race loosely because in reality, we weren't really racing it. We were kind of there for the experience more than anything. You were riding a lovely Quirk made by our good friend Rob Quirk, and you were undergeared, I would say.
Yeah, I would say. I think when it gets hot as well, it's hard to climb. Your heart rate goes up, and then you're like, I've got to stop because otherwise I'm just going to overheat. I think next time I think I'll do what you do and either go one by or put a 40 on the back. I think would just do it.
What were you riding in the end? Were you running a compact on the front?
It was like subcompact. So it's a 46-30.
Yeah. It's like a cross ratios basically.
Yeah, and a 34 on the back. So, you know, it was okay. You're okay on day one, but then as you get fatigued and stuff for like the day two, you're just, fucked really.
And I put a 40 tooth cassette on the rear. And what did I have on the, I had whatever the GRX ratios are. I don't know. It's something random. it's different from what the road and cyclocross ratios are. Basically, it's another additional random gear ratio to just chuck into the pile. As you can hear, my dog is currently picking up his Kong, which he is chewing, because he's a dog and dogs do shit like that. And because he's on crate time, he's not enjoying life at the moment.
Yeah, I'm just expecting my dog to bark at any second, any moment. Yeah.
But the main reason I wanted to, you know, obviously we've been very lucky to share the road on a few different experiences, but I really wanted to talk to you about Rwanda.
Oh yeah.
This as a, from everything I've seen, I've got to make sure I get this right. There's the Tour of Rwanda, there's a race around Rwanda, and there's a mountain bike one as well, if I'm correct.
Yeah, so Simon, who is an ultra racer himself, did quite well in Trans-Pyrenees, Trans-Siberica last year. He runs kind of a few events. It's kind of like all Rwanda beyond. So it's all about giving exposure to, I have a cold, by the way, so That's right. He gives it's all about getting exposure for the East African riders and getting them kind of, because at the end of the day, it's not the bikes that are holding them back, it's not the kit, it's the opportunity to race with the best.
Yeah, of course.
So he's got a week before Race Around Rwanda, it was Rwandan Epic, I think it's called.
Yes, I think you're right.
And it's a 4-day stage mountain bike race. So it was pretty epic. They had some rain. And so, yeah, it made things difficult. They've also got, they're starting Gorilla Gravel. So it's a gravel event.
Yeah.
And then Race Around Rwanda. The Tour of Rwanda is like a separate last, like a road race kind of national event. So,
yeah, I did watch actually some of the Tour of Rwanda this year. And I think it was one stage where it was two Direct Energy riders and a Rwandan rider who were in the breakaway, and yes, they let the Rwandan guy win, which was really lovely. It was really cool.
Oh yeah, I saw that. Yeah,
yeah, it's just a nice little gesture. But basically, both of the Direct Energy guys had won a stage earlier in the race, and were kind of like, you know, you've raced with us, and you've raced freaking hard, and you pulled and everything like that, and they just let him have it, which was actually nice sportsmanship to see. It's definitely a race series, whether it's the Rwandan Epic or the Race Around Rwanda, that I have been really keen to do. But for whatever reason, since I think the Race Around Rwanda's had a couple of editions now, hasn't it?
Yeah, so the first one was in 2020.
Yeah.
And then they couldn't obviously do it last year. But they did, I think last year, and they did it again this year, because the race was originally supposed to be in January. So they did it's called Rwanda, the journey. So basically it's a bikepacking trip, 7 days. So you go off all together, but then you stop each day and camp, or you stay in a hotel or whatever. And, so I signed on in January. So I'd come back. I was in Spain at the time, and I didn't get into GB Giro. So I was like looking for a different event, and my coach he did it in 2020, and so he was like, "Oh, like it's happening in March," and I was like, "Oh, you know, 2 months, that'd be all right, wouldn't it?" to train for, and so yeah, I just went for it.
And let's talk a bit about what the route was like. And like how many days and all the distance, that kind of thing.
So it's 1,000 kilometers, 17,000 meters of climbing. And it's about 60% road, 40% gravel.
That's quite a nice mix, actually.
Oh yeah, no, like, because you, like, I'll talk about how the conditions of the gravel were, but like you the roads were super smooth, like super smooth tarmac, better than the UK. It's like F1 track kind of smooth. So you hit the gravel and then you hit the road, and it's like a relief. And you hit the road, it's like, oh, you know, I've got this to rest now, I can recover. But yeah, 1,000 K, and kind of, I did it in 3 days. But I think the guy that came first, he did it in about 58 hours. So pretty fast route. We got quite good conditions. It didn't rain too much, so if it rains, the gravel is just mud. So
yeah, of course.
Things a lot, and a lot of the guys coming in one or 2 days later, they got the rain, so unfortunately, made things a bit more difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what's quite exciting about it is the varying conditions that you could have. Marshall, stop dropping that. It's very noisy. Yeah, he knows now. He's looking at me like, what are you talking about? I guess like the rain adds another aspect and element to it. And, you know, I remember seeing some of the photos where people just look like they're absolutely caked in like orange mud. Oh, yeah. And it's kind of cool, but yeah, geez.
I mean, day one, you start, so the first 100K is road. Mm. And so we started at like 4:30 in the morning. Yeah, it was like a nice steady pace to the start of the race, like compared to Badlands, where it was like crazy fast for the front guys. This was like really nice, steady pace. We took it easy up the climbs, and then we got long descents. So the first 100K was fairly fairly easy with the sunrise. And then you hit the gravel and kind of, for me, carnage a little bit. Like my saddle came loose. And I think my front tire started to go down. I was a bit bummed about that. But in terms of like,
was it good gravel?
Yeah, so it started off really smooth and like kind of dirt roads kind of, not too many potholes. And then you hit like the Akagera National Park, the outskirts of it. And so it's just like single track. You're hitting like massive puddles, but you're like, I'm going to walk this because I don't know how deep. I have this fear of deep water, like with cycling, or like I'm not cycling through that. That's where all the mud comes from in the first like 100K, 180K. It was just big puddles and stuff like that. You've got like super nice orange gravel, and then you've got boulder sized rocks where like all the small gravel's been washed away. What's left is just this like massive rocks and really rough descents.
In terms of the route, would you say that, well, you said the descents were pretty rough?
Oh yeah, some of them were pretty.
How would you say it compared to, say, the likes of Badlands, for example? One second, I'm gonna stop, take this toy away. I can hear it and it's driving me mad. You're not going to have this one anymore, young man. That's mine now. This will obviously stay in the podcast because...
Of course, you've got to keep the dog in there.
Got to keep the dog happy. Give him a dental chew.
Is this the favourite treat?
These are puppy dental sticks. And they look... I buy them in bulk. It's like a little tube. And my goodness, his face right now when he knows I'm going to bring one of these out... He's buzzing. This is like puppy crack. It's the best way to
put it. I bet it doesn't last long either. I'll just scoff it down and.
Yeah, I mean, he's half Labrador, so he eats a lot.
Yeah.
But what he does is he holds it in his paws, and he just, and they'll be gone in about 5 minutes, if that. He's already eaten half of it in one mouthful. Standard dog. Anyway. Where were we?
I mean, compared to Badlands, I think it was, I think there were sections of it that you could have, I mean, especially that last night, there was one descent, I was like, I could be in Spain right now. The temperatures were similar and it was super smooth. But I think, in terms of roughness in some sections, it was probably worse.
It's like very exciting about, for me, why it really appeals to me as a race is because it's a country that I've never been to and never, maybe is not necessarily been on my list of countries to go to. And that really adds to the excitement of it. And the hospitality and the general vibe of the country seems amazing. Like, it seems like such a fantastically welcoming place.
Yeah. I mean, that was like when I first saw it, I was like, well, I've never been to Africa. I want to explore I tend to only travel with my bike. So I'm always looking for, like, the way I kind of look for races is a kind of, where do I want to ride? Like, where do I want to visit? Is there a race or some sort of bike packing adventure or something like that? So when this came up, I was like, well, it's a fantastic opportunity. And while we were there, it was more the reason, like, you felt the reason you were there was less about the race and was more about the exposure for the Rwandan riders and giving them the opportunity to ride with us and also ride with them, because I mean, there was, so day two to checkpoint three, I rode with a guy called Fazil, and he's like a local runner, triathlete, and he also cycles, and we just rode to checkpoint three and just chatted like everything about Rwanda and his racing, and it was really, like, I think I teared up at one point on one of the descents because I was just, it was just an amazing moment, really, to have that.
I'd imagine very humbling and as you say, very, I think, like, one of the things with so many of these kind of races, whether it's, you know, I've done Silk Road and Atlas Mountains as well, and the allowing yourself to be exposed to cultures that you may not necessarily be exposed to is, I think, incredibly important for everyone. You know, Kyrgyzstan, I really didn't know what to expect when I went there. And I was really quite blown away by how welcoming and, you know, just incredibly hospitable and kind and generous Kyrgyzstan people are. There's definitely much, probably, well, 100% much more of a language barrier with Kyrgyzstan. If you're a white person in Kyrgyzstan, the presumption is you're Russian. So they'll talk to you in Russian, and Russian is kind of the second language or second or third language there, not English. So that obviously became tricky at points, but Google Translate is honestly incredible for those kind of situations when you're trying to have a discussion and, you know, you can kind of get away with talking about things like, you know, you want some food or you want a drink. You can kind of sort, almost like sign it as well in a way. But yeah, like I think there's something so important about, you know, both you and I are middle-aged white men. Like, we are from a relatively privileged point of view. And I think it's incredibly helpful to help us grow as people by doing things like this, going to race around Rwanda or Kyrgyzstan or wherever it is, to grow your understanding of the world much better. I think it's something that I really feel more people should do.
Yeah, and I think with riding a bike as well, like you see places that you would not see as a normal tourist. Yeah. So, you know, I did my first, like, one of my first bike packing trips was in Vietnam, and I went to places that I just wouldn't have been, like villages you go through, especially with this race. Mm-hmm. You know, you go through villages that we are coming through, and like, they don't see any other foreigners at any moment, really, any part in their day. So to go through these villages and to greet all the kids, because you literally say hello to every child in the country, like you're riding along and they're coming out, they've finished school, and they're coming along and they're just like shouting, you know, good morning, hello. And it was, you know, sometimes that got quite annoying, especially if you're tired and you're just like, oh man, like, or if you want to stop, they just surround you and it's, you know, can be overwhelming. But I always thought, well, I couldn't, when I got like that annoyed, I was just like, you can't get annoyed at this. This is amazing. And appreciate it.
Yeah, there were similar situations to that in Kyrgyzstan and in Morocco as well, actually. Morocco is, you know, would be classed as an African country, but it's incredibly westernized. And there's a real mix of cultures in Morocco, but in the proper atlas and stuff, when you're really in the middle of nowhere, like, you'd get groups of kids run out and sort of chase along with you. The only thing that I found in Morocco, and actually talking to like shop owners and people, Moroccans on the route, they were like, a lot of the owners and were saying, like, it's not the men or the women you have to worry about, it's the kids you have to worry about, who are going to be the ones that might try and nick something off your bike, or not in any sort of in spite or in a bad way or anything. It's like a curiosity thing more than anything. And I remember one cafe, like a load of us stopped at this one place. It was like a cafe shop thing, and we all got like Berber omelets, which is an omelet with loads of like cumin in it, effectively. And we all sat at this place, and it was myself and John Woodruff and a couple of others, and we had like about 20 kids just watching us eat. And it does get, as you say, it does get a bit much at points, but you kind of have to go like, this is the, you know, you kind of have to just accept it as what it is, I guess. I remember at one point in Kyrgyzstan, me and Rob Quirk again, we were in the middle of, literally in the middle of nowhere, and we're descending down this mountain, and a group of kids just appeared out of nowhere. And it was like, where have you come from, first of all? you know, stop, and I gave one of them one of my caps, because I had the race cap and I had my own like cycling cap. I gave one of them my cycling caps, and we took some photos with them because they were like, they just wanted to be in photos, basically. I think, like, you know, seeing races like this coming up in countries like Rwanda, it's incredible. Like, it's 100% on my list. It really is. I think there's so many is, as you say, it's not just necessarily about us, or I'm trying to think about how I'm wording stuff very consciously. And it's not just about, you know, a bunch of people from Europe, et cetera, traveling there. There's a much bigger picture to it and a much bigger story to it, and showcasing the potential and the real talents that so many African riders have. And we're starting to see that come through in even at World Tour level. Slowly we're getting there, and it's going to take, there's a lot of work to do still, but it's great to see that the steps are going in the right way. Whether that was, you know, when we had MTN Quebeca, then Dimension Data, then NTT or Quebeca Assos, and whatever sort of name the team had, having that team at World Tour level when Daniel Tecklaheimer won the King of the Mountains jersey at the Tour of France, to more recently, the name of the race is going to...
Yeah, is it the East African rider that won the one of the day races recently?
Yeah, the Eritrean guy.
I he won that shortly after I left, so it was like kind of, it felt really like just coming from Rwanda, and the guys, knowing the guys there and going, I know they would have seen that and gone like, that's incredible, like, and giving them that confidence to kind of know, you know, we can do this. And yeah, definitely, for sure.
The race, I'm gonna find it because it was nuts. It was excuse me if I butcher the name. I very much apologize. It's Binyamin Gamai, who's from Eritrea. And the race was Gent-Wevelgem. And he won it. And like, it went down. I remember watching it. And because Gamai, I think he, in the under 23 world champs just gone, he won the sprint for like second place as well, which was mega in its own right. And then he's always looked, I love the one day classics and spring races. I'm a huge fan of that. So that, to me, that's cycling, not the Tour de France. It's the one day classics. That's the proper riding. And he has looked really good in all of the other like one day races leading up to Gent-Wevelgem. And then he was in the breakaway in Gent-Wevelgem, and it was him. It was Christophe Laporte. It was someone from Trek, and it was someone from Total Energies. It was the four riders in the breakaway. And, you know, Christophe Laporte was probably the favorite to win it, judging on his form and how Jumbo Visma had been racing. But then Gamai was just like, he was racing incredibly well. Like, he, you know, he's young. I think he's like 22. And to see a rider of that age performing at that level with, you know, the best spring racers in the world, is amazing. And the bit that I loved even more was the fact that, you know, Gent-Wevelgem is the kind of the lead, one of the lead up races, I guess, to Tour Flanders, Ronde van Vlaanderen. And they're like, oh, you're going to stay, aren't you? You're going to do the Ronde and all this sort of stuff. Because he was going home. He's planned to go home after Gent-Wevelgem back to Eritrea. And he's like, no, I'm still going home. I want to go and see my wife, and I want to go see my son. And like,
very humble, yeah.
Very humble, and massive respect for sticking to that. And also for Intermarché Wanty-Groubert allowing him to still do that. Like, massive respect to the team for allowing him to do that. And then we go and see freaking, you know, he was in the team and Alexander Christophe was in the team. And I love Christophe because he's a brute. He just rides really well on the hard days. And it was Schwel de Pries yesterday, probably butchered the pronunciation, apologies, but it's another, you know, one day race. Christophe rode off the front with 7K to go and won. So this one win for a team that, you know, when that team basically took the World Tour license from CCC when that team folded, and it really struggled for the first year. And then, you know, they've had some really great little moments, like Gamay winning, like Taco van der Hoorn. I think he won a stage. I can't remember if it was a Giro or the Tour de France, but he won a stage from a breakaway. Like, these little things is great to see. And then, as we said, like seeing a rider, it was the first African rider to win a one-day race, like a spring classics race. It's massive. massive, massive thing.
And I think, I think it will be interesting to see what's, you know, because with the, speaking to them about the fact that the World Championships is going to be in Rwanda in 2025, and just kind of, that's going to be, like, if, to be honest, if any time you want to go to Rwanda, that's probably a good, and you're into cycling, that's a really good time to go. Because I expect it's going to be massive. So, really.
I think as well, what they're, because I think the next, I think this year's World Championships in Australia, if I remember rightly, and then the 2024 is Glasgow, I think. And what they're trying to do going forward is have all of the cycling World Championships at the same time. So road, time trial, track, BMX, mountain biking. I don't know about I think cyclocross as well. I think that's definitely the plan for Glasgow, is to have it all at the same time. Yeah. So it's a real festival of cycling. And if they do that again, if they manage to do that as well in Rwanda, it'd be incredible. It'd be absolutely incredible.
Yeah, to have a, like, you know, I was talking to Josh Ibbett. He did both races, so he did the Epic and race around Rwanda. And speaking to him about the race and how he was like, how that was, and then coming over, it was really, some of the terrain is, because like the elevation of Rwanda is the base elevation is like 1400 meters.
Oh, wow.
So we, you know, when you fly into Kigali, which is the capital, it's 1400 meters, and you, like, we go down maybe for the start of the race. So it's maybe like, you know, 1300, but still really, really high. And we, I think the highest point was 2800.
Wow.
So we spent most of the day, like the first night I slept. So checkpoint two was at 2000 meters, and that was at the African Cycling Center, the Rising Cycling Center. And I think they're talking about it becoming a UCI center as well. So it was, you know, had a kitchen, we had like beds, and then obviously a mechanic was there as well. So for anybody that had problems with their bikes, you know, while you slept, you could have a mechanic sort your bike out.
That's amazing. That's absolutely incredible.
The first day was that was just wanted to get to checkpoint two. So that was at 385K. Mm. And we'd done like that's three gravel sections. So all together was like nine sectors. So I was planning to get to checkpoint two. And because of my front puncture and stuff, I was slowed down nearer the end, but I just kept pushing until we got there. And I'm glad I did, because the bed was a warm shower and a bed. That's
worth its weight in gold. That
important. Yeah, I didn't take any sleeping gear with me, because I was like, I know, like in Rwanda, you're not going to sleep out. Like in Spain, you know, we could just find, you could go through the night and go, well, at some point I'm going to sleep. Whereas here, you kind of had to either, you either slept in a hotel, or, you know, that was the only option really, to do that. So
is that more for safety more than anything?
Yeah, well, Rwanda's a very, very populated country, and like at any time of the night. So this last gravel section that was going through the Twin Lakes up to checkpoint two, I'm putting a tube in my tire, because I was just like not pumping this up anymore. Luckily it held for the rest of the trip. But yeah, I mean, there was a guy, it was like 1 o'clock in the morning, and this guy was just like just walking up the hill while I was, and he just stood there and watched me fix my tire. And it's like, it is like that, like at any point in the night, like the times I did ride through the night, you know, you're riding and then suddenly somebody's there, or somebody's walking along the path, and you're like, oh, like they've got no lights, nothing. So it's kind of like, it does startle you a bit. The last night I slept for 20 minutes on the pavement. But that's as close as I did sleeping out. Then I just stayed at the checkpoints, really.
Yeah. And how many checkpoints were there in the race?
So there was four checkpoints. And then obviously the start and the finish as well.
There's plenty of checkpoints as well, isn't that?
Oh, yeah. 1,000
kilometers.
So the first checkpoint was at 185K. So we did that like by lunchtime. And we got there and they were like, I asked for some water, and they're like, yeah, we've only got one bottle left.
Oh, wow.
I was like, okay. And Simon was like, oh, the water was supposed to be here like 4 hours ago. because things are just taking. And luckily, I think the riders coming in, they got water in, luckily. Because yeah. I felt bad for taking the last one, but I got some food. And then, so each checkpoint, there was possibility to sleep and to eat and to fill up and refuel. So.
Yeah, that's good. That's really, really good. And what, in terms of the bike setup you had, so what were the gear ratios you were riding? What did you take, like, kit wise?
Yeah, so I rode my Quirk again, and the same gear ratios as Badlands, because of the road sections as well. I was kind of very like that. I don't think it's going to be super, super steep. Yep. And I was pretty happy with it. There were times when I walked, but that was just because I was like, I fancy a walk.
Yeah.
You do. Like sometimes you just mix it up and if it's rough and stuff. So, but in terms of the bikes, I put 38 mil tires on, which I think was probably standard for most people, but I think I could have got away with maybe 40 mils. But the clearance on the bike maxes out of that. So in terms of kit, I just had saddlebag and a top tube bag. I was going to have a front feed bag. But the night before I was like faffing around the hotel room and then I was putting food in the bag and the zip, like, I just was like, oh, I was like, okay, I didn't really want to take that bag anyway, but it was more of a necessity to carry more stuff. So I just rearranged stuff in my pockets. And so other than that, like all I had was like arm warmers, leg warmers. I had a windproof jacket or like a waterproof super light, and then another jacket. So two jackets, a buff and a pair of gloves. I think that was it.
That's crazy, isn't it? It's like, it really shows how little you really need. I'm just looking on the Instagram and stuff for it, looking at kind of other people's setups and things. And there are people that have got, you know, top tube bag, frame bag, saddle bag, you know, like the whole hydration packs as well. Like some people really are carrying quite a lot of stuff. And in contrast, I mean, I really am a believer that a lot of people take too much stuff on these trips.
Yeah.
You know, if it's been a success, if you have used everything you packed once.
I did, yeah. I set the gloves. I didn't use the gloves because it didn't. We were told it might get really cold at night and stuff and at like 2,000 meters. And it was, but it wasn't. If you were riding, you were absolutely fine.
It was the same at Badlands, wasn't it? They were sort of saying to us that it will get really cold at night, and my God, it didn't. I took a pair of like winter gloves. I didn't use them once at Badlands. There was one bit of kit I didn't use.
There was that last night for me. I slept. I think it was like that was at 1,000 meters, and I got so cold. So I put I had waterproof trousers on me. It was like mainly for warmth. That wasn't for rain, but for warmth. And I just had everything on because. But yeah, no, for this, because I also staying in hotels, I was kind of like not like I've done enough bike packing and I've, you know, and I like going lightweight. That's, you know, I like fast packing and stuff. So my saddle bag was just full of like hydration stuff, like I had some energy products. And so I knew that it was going to get lighter as you went on. Yeah. I think I used every bit of kit, as you said, and there wasn't really much else I would have taken. I did think about a puffer jacket, which is something that you generally take on every event. But with this, it was kind of like, well, I'm going to be staying in hotels, so it's not too bad.
Not essential. Just looking at, I found a photo of you, I believe at the finish, and your bike is like caked in orange.
Yeah.
Two big water bottles, small saddle pack, top tube bag, dynamo lights.
Yeah.
And then running Ultegra DI2 as well, and then Parkour's outer wheels with a dynamo hub on the front.
For the dynamo light, I it's mainly because I don't want to have to think about charging lights. I don't mind charging my phone, I don't mind charging the Garmin, like that's not too bad, but lights is something that I just want to have. Sometimes I have them on all day, and I just I don't want to have to worry about them. So having the dynamo as much is such a helpful thing.
And you're running big water bottles as well.
Yeah, the litre, 1 litres.
Where do you find litre water bottles?
Those I found on, I think I bought them from Sigma. They're just the, what's the brand?
Camelback.
Elite. They're the Elite. They're just the Elite. So I generally ride like 750 bottles, but for this and Badlands as well, it's like, you know, it could get in the day, you just need as much water as possible.
Yeah, definitely. And then you've got Absolute Black chain rings because they make one of those, the subcompact chain ring set, don't they? Yeah. And then 1130 on the back, 160 rotors front and rear, looks like.
Yeah, I changed the rotors a few weeks before.
Yeah.
Just needed some extra power.
And then
definitely came in handy.
Yeah. And then are they Panaracer Gravel King tires?
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
I don't. Tires are a thing. Obviously, people can take or leave my opinion because I am sponsored by a tire brand, which is Schwalbe. And the big reason why I started working with Schwalbe was actually they were the tire brand I was always buying anyway. I really like how the Pro Ones ride on the road. And then before I was sponsored by them, I was like ducking and diving between so many different gravel tire options. There's so many choices out there. And I did use Panaracers when I did Atlas Mountains. That was before I started working with Schwalbe. I used Panaracers then, and my God, the amount of punches I had at Atlas Mountains on those tires. I think they are a good, like, they're quite a thin gravel tire. So the like rolling resistance is low, quite low on them, and they're quite good when you're crossing over onto the road. But Atlas Mountains, I think I had 6 punches during that race, and I was just like, and the problem is that when that happens, that then negates your like for that tire, you know, if it's a continuing thing. For me anyway, I appreciate that it's very different for everyone else. And also,
ideally I would have used Pirelli. Pirelli are my like go-to tires, but they don't do a 38, and the 40s blow up on the Alters. They're 42 mil.
Yeah.
So, and my clearance on the front, I get away with it. That's why in Badlands I had 2 different tires, because the rear, the clearance wasn't enough with the front derailleur. Mm-mm. So ideally I would have used Pirellis, but yeah, I mean, they're good enough, I think.
All tires are now very good.
Yeah.
It's just knowing what's appropriate for what kind of grip, et cetera, that you want. It's like I've recently on my mountain bike just changed tires over from a Racing Ralph and a Racing Ray, the Addicts, I think, what ones are they? The Racing Addicts ones, which is the like lightweight, proper racing mountain bike tire. So the puncture protection's a bit lower. And the grip, the Racing Ralph and Racing Ray, the tread is not very deep on them. So for like Atlas Mountains, they would be the tire I'd use for that. I'm fully intending to go, I'm doing Atlas Mountains in 2023, and I'm going to do it on a mountain bike because pretty adamant it's not a gravel bike race, really. But I've just switched over on my Santa Cruz to a, I'm trying to read the sidewalls now because it's in front of me, a knobby Nick on the front and a Wicked Will on the rear. And they are the slightly thicker compound, so a bit more puncture proof. They're black walls as opposed to the like tan sidewalls, which is on the Racing Ralph from Ray, which actually look really nice on the Santa Cruz. But I'm a big believer in using different tires front and rear. And it's one of the things Schwalbe always shout about is you use one that's more grippy on the front and one which is not as grippy on the rear. They've always shouted about it for mountain biking. And then at Badlands, I rode 650B outers with a, God, this is going to test my brain now. I used a G1 Ultra Bite on the front and a G1 Bite on the rear. And the theory is, and it does seem pretty legit to me, is that you have the grippier tire on the front where you don't necessarily have the weight. And so when you're going up some quite steep, sketchy stuff, you've got the grip there. And then you have the one that is a bit less grippy on the rear because you've got all the weight on the rear of the bike, but also it helps with the rolling resistance. So it seems very logical in my head. And that setup on Badlands was perfect. I was really, really impressed with it. I've never used Pirelli tires. I know them. To me, they were, when my dad used to race motorbikes, that was the brand of tire. He used Pirelli's. That was the only tire brand he'd used. And he had a set which he called Old Faithful, which was a set of Pirelli's that somehow lasted like three seasons, and they were shredded, but he still used to race in them, which was a bit mad. I think he just liked how they handled. But yeah, there are so many options out there for, like, the gravel market for tires is insane at the moment. It's just crazy how many different choices there are out there. And every brand does a gravel tire and a cyclocross tire and a mountain bike tire that would fit on a gravel bike, you know. And there's probably like three or four different options, whether you want something that's a high puncture proof, low rolling resistance, something that's good in mud, something that's good in gravel, something that's good in sand. There's so many choices now, isn't there? It's crazy.
Oh, I think it's just a case of you choose a tire, and if you like it and you're confident with it, you stick with that. Like, it's like, if my customers are asking me kind of what suggestions for tires, it's kind of like, well, it's, I'm suggesting what I use, but somebody else might have something. Like, for you, Schwalbe is what you use and you've used for years. But then, you know, I think also price range as well, because the Gravel Kings aren't super expensive. Like, the Pirellis are slightly more. So it depends on, like, kind of your budget as well, I think, as well.
As you just alluded to there very briefly, you're also a bike mechanic, aren't you?
I am.
And
so, yeah,
that's very useful when you do bike ultimately. And you work as, am I right that you're a mobile mechanic?
Yeah, so kind of in terms of I offer collection, so makes it a lot easier for people if they don't drive or the bike is broken and they can't get it to a bike shop.
Yeah, of course.
So yeah, no, but I kind of mobile work and have a workshop, so yeah
it's really, really good. And
but for the races as well, like I was fine. I get there and then we start and I'm like, I'm off duty.
So you get people who are, yeah, like, oh, can you just have a look at this quickly?
Yeah. No, we met, speaking of that, like in Badlands, we guy called Eddie, we got really friendly and stuff, and he used to use the same coach, and he had a few problems at the start and ended up riding to checkpoint two with only one brake, but luckily got it sorted. Like, so to get round with so many problems, like, absolute legend to get to finish and to keep going. Cause, and like, at that point you're just like, do I carry on or?
Yeah. Well, that's when I did Silk Road, one of my brakes quite badly failed. The piston in the caliper, there's a ceramic piston in it, and it cracked. And so that, and then chucks out all the, this is like the very early Shimano, I guess it was like a road hydraulic disc brake, but it's very, very early. It's like the first one they did. And yeah, the piston cracked. And there's no way you're going to get brake fluid or any way of solving that in the middle of, in the middle of Kyrgyzstan. And it happened at the top of a climb, and basically Rob and myself, we filed, it was the front brake that failed. And so we filed the cable guides off the bottom of my Quirk and took the rear brake and mounted it on the front just because it's nicer in terms of descending, found it much nicer and felt safer that way. And we got to the checkpoint and I was like, I don't think it's going to be wise to continue with one brake going into, basically we're at the point where we were about to go and ride along the Chinese border, which is kind of known as being the middle of nowhere really out there. And it was a struggle because, like, I only had one brake, front brake is overheating. You can hear it overheating, and where it makes that, like, and the pads are just getting absolutely shredded when it starts to make that horrible, like, watery noise.
Oh, I know what you mean. Yeah.
And I was just like, yeah, probably should scratch now, because it's, for me, it was at a point of like, this could get dangerous. And I guess with Badlands, like, what was quite good about that as a race is you were never really too far away from a town or something if something could happen. Even the desert, you're still...
And also, you were never that far from anybody else as well. Like, there was like two... Well, we still... What was it? 260 people started that race. Yeah, a lot dropped out, but like, you were always in striking distance of somebody or a town or something. So, luckily, the only punches are probably the only thing. But I didn't get any punches in Badlands, and so I give the bike a... Like, I don't take any chances or anything like that. Everything's checked before the race, and luckily, no problems.
But. Yeah, exactly. What would be, now, with your cycling mechanic head on, what do you think is, like, five things that people always do wrong with their bikes or should learn to do?
Oh.
That's a good question, huh?
Yeah, five things. That's quite, you know... No, I think checking your chain wear, that's got to be number one. Because when I pick bikes up and I pick them up because I inspect each bike before I then quote the customer and everything. The first thing I check is the chain, because it tells me if the cassette is worn, if the chain rings are like absolutely, you can look at those. But generally, that's the one thing that it's one thing people don't check. Brake pad wear. Stuff like that, checking, being able to change your brake pads, tires, running the right pressure, like making sure your tires are pumped up. So, you know, tire wear is obviously going to be a thing if you've got correct pressure in, they'll last longer. That's three things. I think learning to just do basic maintenance, like adjusting gears and stuff, that's something that is a little bit more technical, but it can save you time and a lot of money because you just, I think just generally getting your bike checked regularly for wear, bearings wear and stuff like that. It just saves, like I had a guy last week, he came in from full service. I did nothing to the bike other than the basic full service. So checked everything, the chain and everything. And he was like, yeah, I like to maintain it and I like to check it often, so I save myself money. So that was kind of,
that's a very similar stance to what I have, really. Like, the especially when the chain is a really good point, because if the chain gets too worn, and then it's very easy that the chain rings and cassette get worn, and if you change the chain regularly, you're probably not going to have to change chain rings and cassette that often.
No,
and the difference in cost between a chain and chain rings and cassette and a chain is quite significant, obviously dependent on the group set, but I literally had to buy a set of Durace compact chain rings for a project I'm doing because I can't get hold of them anywhere. And I bought a set online from a shop, and I think it was like 160 quid chain rings. Yeah. A cassette could be anything really, I guess, from like, I don't know, 40 quid to probably 200 quid for a Durace one. I don't even know how much they are now.
I mean, for like Ultegra, like your chain, you're looking at like 30 to 40 quid. Cassette's like 80 quid. And then your chain rings obviously go up over 100. So the way it goes is if you change your chain, like if you don't, then each thing becomes more and more expensive. Basically.
And then the other one is obviously changing brake pads, especially with disc brake bikes. It maybe isn't so easy to see when they're worn, but
no. But I think if you look at for the front, you just look directly through, like from the front, from the through axle, the quick release, just look straight through at the pads, and you can easily see whether they're worn or not. Mm-hmm. So.
And generally speaking, if you need to replace the fronts, you're probably going to need to replace the rear as well.
Yeah. And if you're getting them bled as well, you might as well change the pads at the same time, if they're, you know, fairly been used. So
the one I always find is, you know, you put fresh pads in and the pistons are too close because it's fresh pads where they just adjust themselves to be pulled in closer.
Push the pistons out when you change the pattern, then you can readjust it. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. Yeah,
yeah. But yeah, no, luckily no mechanicals in Rwanda. And I mean, other than like I found the bike, I love riding the Quirk. It's the most comfiest bike I've I mean, it is custom, so there is that. Like, at the end of the day, any custom bike is fitted to you direct. And I've got quite a small reach. Mm. So I don't think there's many bikes out. Like, I think it's 340 mil, which is, like, ridiculously short. Like, it's shorter than most, like, extra small frames. And so finding a frame, so that's where I went with Quirk. And the steel is just super, super comfy. Like, over
for,
the,
for reference, gravel, how tall are you?
Yeah. Oh, like, 5'6".
Yeah, so you are... is having such a short reach as well, and I'm not saying you're short, but you're shorter than shorter than average male, yeah. I would say. But like, it's the biggest thing is, I'm a huge believer in a bike fit. Like, if you're gonna buy a bike, get a bike fit. Like, say you've got, I don't know, say you've got £2,000, yeah, spend 300 quid on that, or whatever it is, 400 quid on that, on a bike fit, and getting the bike set up properly for you. And if you don't, you know, and if you can't find a bike that works properly for your fit, go custom, 100%. Yeah. Because it's going to bring you so much more pleasure and joy. And at the end of the day, we ride bikes because they're big kids' toys for us, you know. We do it because we enjoy it. So having a bike that fits you properly is going to allow you to ride further, ride faster, and enjoy your experience on the bike more. And the thing that you've got to make sure is correct is the contact points. So pedals, saddle, handlebars. So where the handlebars are, how high, how low, how far forward, how far back. The saddle being right to your butt. The pedals, like crank arm length, you know, spindle length, like all those kind of things play into it massively so.
And I think, to be honest with it, like 90% of people have a bike that's too big for them.
I agree. Because,
yeah, like you'd be better off going size smaller and going slight, maybe changing it slightly. But yeah, I think the bikes are too big for people, basically.
I really agree with you.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I'm 5'11". I ride a 54. Yeah. A lot of people, I could ride a 56. I could quite happily ride a 56, but I prefer how a 54 feels. I like the fact that, to me, when I ride a 54, it feels nippy. And I like that. And, you know, I've got long arms, long legs, short torso. So all my bikes look great because they've all got long stems and a lot of seat pokes showing. So as a...
Yeah, I don't understand. You've got that. I look at that stem and go, how can you ride with such a long stem? But it works for you and your company, so it doesn't matter.
Right, to me, and I'm super comfortable. I'm more comfortable on... So my... For reference for setup on me, I'm 5'11". My Cervelo R5, which is in front of me, so I can kind of go through it and look at it quite literally. I ride a 130 stem, which is Cervelo's own integrated stem, which sounds very long. The handlebars are, I think they're 40 mils, but Cervelo's handlebars measure slightly wider on the drop, so probably nearer a 42 on the drop. They're slightly flared. My saddle height is 7'8" 4, I think it is, which is quite high. The saddle I'm using on that bike is the Pro Stealth lightweight saddle in the wider width, which is, I think, a 1.52 mil. And then I ride a 170 crank arm. I could ride a 172.5. I could ride a 165. I could ride a 175. I just like how 170 feels. I ride a 165 crank on my TT bike. And that's to do with position. You know, your hips are tilted further forward. I found when I was riding a 170 on the TT bike, I felt like I was kicking myself in the stomach. So 165.
And you increase your cadence as well a little bit.
Exactly, know, exactly.
165. So, I mean, I run 165. That's standard on all my bikes. But except if you go mountain bike, then you can't get 165. Yeah, no, I just think bike fits. That's the best investment. I think that's more the better investment than the bike itself, I think, sometimes. Because now I have like, I had a bike fit with James, and it was revolutionary. Like, in terms of like, I'd never even thought reach was something I would look at. And so, you know, now when I look at bikes, it's really hard to find a bike that fits me. So yeah, it's something that's worth getting.
So what on your Quirk, you've got, it's quite a short stem on it, isn't it?
So I had a 70 mil, But I put a new saddle on like last year before Badlands, and I couldn't get the saddle as far back as I wanted. So I put, as far back. So I put an 80 mil stem on, but the reach is like 60, like from tip of the saddle to the handlebars is like 61, mm-hmm. 60.5. So quite short.
The other thing to bear in mind as well is that you need to regularly, like I have a sort of like an updated fit at least once a year where I just go check everything's still okay. Cause your body changes over time. Like, you know, as you get older, you become less flexible with these kind of things. I'm very lucky that I have a hyper flexible back. So it's actually, for me, it's way more comfortable to be riding more aggressively than being more upright. It just is more comfortable. But you know, that could change over time. So the other, leading on the caravan, the importance of bike fit is also the importance of keeping on top and checking it. And the any good bike fitter is going to say, if you have an option, a few issues, any good bike fitter is going to be wanting to help out and solve those issues again and help you. The big one for me has been shoes, as I have so many issues with shoes. So
we talked about that, didn't we, in Spain? Because my feet were expanded and I had like numb feet for like 2 weeks afterwards.
Yeah, what shoes were you riding?
The gravel Shimano shoes.
Gravel Shimano ones.
You said they were quite narrow.
The Shimano's gravel shoes, I found them way too narrow for me, and they are narrower than their road shoes. They've Shimano have also now bought out a wide fit on road shoes. I don't know if they've done it on the gravel ones, but they have done it on the mountain bike ones. My problem with feet is I have big, wide and flat feet, which in cycling terms is like the three deadly sins of shoes. So very few brands work for my feet. Shimano, actually their wide fit ones seem to be pretty good for me. Then the ones that aren't wide fit, I can ride in, but same thing, I get numb feet because feet expanding in the heat and stuff. So they're fine. The normal standard width ones are fine in the winter, for example, but the wide ones actually seem pretty good. I then sort of switched over to Lake to try Lake out, and I sort of got on with them at points and then didn't get on with them, and like they're incredibly stiff is the thing that I found, they're okay, but they're not perfect. There's definitely going to be something better out there for me. I'm very impressed with Lake as a brand and the range they do and the options they do, because they do so many different options for width. For that, I found the width was good. And in Badlands, I used the gravel shoe, and I actually had quite a few issues with it. And I think that partly comes down to setup, and partly comes down to I raced that race injured, so it probably didn't help. And now my latest experiment is Bonds. I'm going to try out Bonds. Yeah. So I was always very hesitant to try Bonds because my first pair of road shoes were Bonds and I did not like them. This is going back a very long time. So anyway, I've ordered some Bonds. Just the caravat here, I paid for Lakes, I've paid for Bonds, and Shimano have provided me with shoes in the past, but very genuinely have bought I think I've probably bought about 10 different pairs of shoes over the last couple of years to try them out and try and work out what works. Because ultimately, you can't really tell. I don't think you can tell when you try them on, first of all. You need to actually ride in them a bit and get a bit of the feel of it, which becomes an expensive test, but it is what it is, all in the name of comfort. So I ordered some Bonds in November, and they arrived on Monday. So...
Oh, you're going to try them. Yeah.
Yeah, pretty crazy. Yeah. They took that long. But yeah, I ordered them in November. They arrived on Monday. So I've got them to try out. There's always so many inconsistencies with sizes as well. Like I'm a 47 in most brands, but Bonds are 46.5 according to their measurement cards. But yeah, like this all goes down to having a bike fit. Like they're all things that will be discussed, and a bike fitter will try and advise you on what they believe is the right kind of shoe for you, which is... Lake is quite often one that is suggested, and so is Bonds. And you know that every person's feet are completely different. Some people have wide, some people have narrow. But it's a massive believer in going and spending like half a day with a fitter and just working through the motions. And, you know, even if you've got an existing bike, get that bike dialed in the best you can to make it as comfortable as possible. And you'll also quite quickly learn if that bike just doesn't work for you.
Yeah, and then that's the hard, that's the I think that's the one thing that people say to me, I don't want to go because I don't want to be told that I've got to swap everything out or I need a new bike, because they might have, well, they might have just spent loads of money on a bike and like, and then gone, ah, it doesn't fit me. And it's quite, and I think that does, so I think, I mean, the fit first thing, like for future purchases, just get the fit first, and then that bike fitter can then recommend bikes for you, so you can, you know, you're not just going by just the looks, you're going by, will this bike fit me? Because I always, the first thing I do is look at the geometry, and then try and match it as close to, if I'm looking for another bike, I'm looking at the geometries and stuff. But yeah,
there's some great tools out there. Yeah, there's some great tools out there, like the podcast that will have come out today. This is, it's Thursday the 7th of whatever month we're in, April. The podcast that goes live today is discussing something which allows you to compare bike geometries, called Velo Match. And it's my friend Darren Franks, who does, he's done like TCR and Trans Am and loads of mental things. He's one of the co-founders of it. And Velo Match is this tool which allows you to say, you've got your bike fit data, you literally implement your bike fit data into it, and it will show you all the bikes that will work for your fit. Like, it'll be like, this one will be the closest fit, this one you might have to adjust like stem, etc. But like, it'll show you the options that are there. Equally, if you don't know your bike fit, but you've got like a bike that works well with you. So say you've got like, if it's me, if I go, oh, I've got a 54 Cervelo R5. Okay, put that in, that works for me. And then they'll be like, these ones should all work for you. It's a very, very clever tool that it just doesn't feel like anyone else has quite nailed it. Because there are options out there where you could compare the geometry and stuff off frames. But I think for a lot of, you know, people, that can be quite confusing, understanding what all the different terminologies are for geometry. But then what Darren's done with Velo Match is very good at sort of showing you, if you ride this one, this could also work, this could also work, this could also work. A really cool tool that he's done. I've plugged that now quite a lot because I think it's cool.
Yeah, and I think as well, like, you know, for us doing ultra races, it fit is just imperative. Like, it's the one thing that has to work, because, you know, your body's gonna break down. I mean, even 3-day race, your body's gonna break down, and you don't want it to be because of the bike fit. You want it to be because really rough terrain, or you want it to be, you know, you don't want it to break down at all. But at the end of the day, you're trying to take away all the stuff that's going to slow down or affect you.
Yeah, as a rider. Yeah, it's the bit that when I've been speaking to Cervelo recently about the range of bikes and the subsequent bikes that are coming out as well, which I think is not old news. If you read anything like Cycling Tips, they pretty much disclosed three of the bikes that Cervelo are bringing out over this year. But one of the things that really, I think, interested me and was very logical actually in discussing the range of the bikes and why certain bikes have been bought out and designed, and the elements of why they're designed the way they are, is the newest R5 is designed to be more comfortable, so less stiff than the previous R5. One example. And the reason why they did that was because the smaller, like svelte Grand Tour riders who would be riding the R5 during a Grand Tour were like, this, the previous generation was stiff. Like, it was because power transfer, it was very stiff. And they were feeling it after 3 weeks. So they made it more comfortable, and they very openly put it out there in the, you know, when they released the newest R5, saying, we've made this bike more comfortable than the previous one because it's less stiff. In our contrast, the other thing that they regularly talk about is how the Caledonia and the Caledonia 5 is probably the bike for 90% of people in terms of geometry. You know, it's a bit more relaxed. It has a lower bottom bracket and a wider wheelbase, so it feels much more stable. And for people who aren't racing, you don't need to have a high bottom bracket to get around corners. You don't need to have a shorter wheelbase, which allows it to sort of handle a bit nippier. You can have it to be a bit longer and lower to be more stable. And what they've done, they're very open about the fact that this is a bike that's, one, designed for big adventures and silly ride, but also probably the bike for most people in terms of comfort and fit.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just finding it's a minefield. Like me and Rob, I think our email count was over 100.
Bloody hell, yeah.
Like for choosing geometry, but not just geometry, but paint jobs and everything. It was like over 100, and it was, you know, every detail was thought of. Yeah.
That's the custom.
Yeah. Exactly.
Who painted the one in the end?
He said that he was changing at the time.
Yeah, he's changed.
And I don't know if it was coal coatings still or not. I can't remember.
Yeah, because all the early ones are done with coal coatings. My one was done with coal coatings, and I can't remember who he's changed to now, but he's been sort of using a few different people to paint them now.
He needed
to do with demand and getting them in places, which is great, which is really great. Do you know what number frame your one is?
Number 97. Because of COVID and everything, it was like nearly, I think it was like 10 months or something. And I was kind of like, oh, I'm really, really, really hoping it's under 100. Because I think I met somebody or something, and they had like 50 or something like that. And I was like, I really hope it's under 100. And when I arrived, I the first thing I looked at, and I was like, yes, got it. And because he had 100 hanging up, ready to be sent to paint or ready to be built. And I mean, that's also a good number to have as number 100. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, they do say with like custom frames, if you can get it, the lower numbers are the ones that seem to weirdly hold their value and stuff.
What number is yours?
I think it's like 30 something.
Yeah, so.
I can't remember off the top of my head. It's early. It's quite early in Rob's build list. It might even be early. It might be lower than 30. It's definitely under 50, basically.
Yeah.
But, you know, Ben, I've had that bike, God, 5-6 years, something like that.
Yeah.
I've still got it. It's hanging up on the wall at the moment, kind of not really built up. It's kind of a bit battered. It's still battered and a bit broken after... Silk Road. So it was kind of built back up to sort of work as well as possible, but I've taken my mate has got the front mech of it, for example, because he needed a front mech, so I was like, oh, you can borrow mine for the time being, because I couldn't ride the bike, and then like the rear mech I need to take it off to use for another project and stuff like that. So it's sort of been the bike that's hanging up on the wall in, you know, kind of safe and special, but has been had a few bits and bobs sort of taken off it here and there. But it's a bike that I will never get rid of, because ultimately it was made for me by my mate, you know?
Yeah. It's a piece of art, but as I spoke to Rob, it was like, it's tall at the end of the day. And mine's battered, and I didn't get mine Invisiframed or anything, but I plan to get it resprayed probably in the next year. And I'll get it Invisiframe then. But then I do like the idea of the scratches. Like some of them was like, oh, I got that when I crashed in here, and I got this when I went down this descent in like in Rwanda or like whatever. Like my rear derailleur, I crashed. So I got there like a week before the start of the race.
Mm.
So I always try and get to the race like maybe like 4 days. Depends where it is. If it's Spain, it's fairly close. You can go to a bike shop, whatever. But because of the distance of travel and everything, I was like, okay, let's get there early. Went for a ride with a few people that were there, and I crashed. And I was like, I slightly hurt my wrist, and I was like, oh, okay, I've got 2 days to recover. Hopefully everything's fine. Everything was. But yeah, I scratched up my like rear derailleur, and I was like, I have done some respraying of rear derailleurs and Ultegra like color matching, but I was like, well, I'll keep that because that's a crash that I had.
I think it's quite nice. At the end of the day, these bikes they're toys for us, so everyone puts them to look nice, but also they are tools, and it's quite nice that, you know, that there's these stories about scuffs and scratches and stuff like that. Like my Aspero 5 has got quite a few little chips and dinks in the paintwork from Badlands because, you know, just the nature of it, where you just, it's just things like where you're knackered and you just put the bike down, you don't realize exactly what you put it on. I'm trying to think of any other ones that have got particular marks on it. That's the one that's got the most sort of marks and scuffs on it that I can think of off the top of my head. The one that I did 107 TDF on, the Cervelo R3, before it was repainted. My God, that has some chips and scuffs in it. One of them was from when I leant up against the sign for Land's End that wasn't there, and it fell off. And you know, these things happen at the end of the day. But they, you know, I think there was, I read somewhere that, I think it's Speed Bargain, they will, you can pay them to scratch your bike before they send it to you.
Yeah, drop a spanner on it or something.
Yeah, exactly. A part of me is like, yeah, that's cool, because then you don't, it takes away the onus of the first one. But I think they charge like $100 for it or something ridiculous.
And also, like, it's, the scratch doesn't mean anything. It's not, exactly. It's just, it doesn't have a meaning. It doesn't have a, memory or whatever. I luckily didn't crash for the rest of the ride. I was pretty, I got out of the system. I was like, I really hope it doesn't happen again. Cause if I land on my wrist again, it would, you know, I hadn't done super, like a lot of gravel training leading up, cause I don't tend to do a lot over the winter just because of how like muddy it is and everything. But so when I got there and did the first ride, I felt pretty battered. But luckily, my body just quickly got used to it. And,
yeah, so what's
ideal.
What's the plan for the rest of the year?
So I'm doing Trans Pyrenees in June, end of June.
Awesome.
So similar.
That's the one run by the Trans Siberica group, isn't it?
Yeah. So that's 25th of June, I think. Yeah. So I've got about 10 weeks now of training to do, and looking forward to it. It's going to be, because nice. I think after Badlands, I improved a lot in Rwanda. So I obviously the alarm problem thing and oversleeping I didn't do, but I managed to feel better, and I think that was the biggest thing. Nutrition is the biggest when it comes to these races, is the biggest thing.
Completely agree.
Managing that and just so I ate better, and also I was a bit more confident with the lack of sleep. Like with Badlands, I was like, first night I was like, oh, I've got to sleep 4 hours. I was like, that seems to be good, or 3 hours. But this time around, I was like, okay, let's try two. And it worked quite well.
Yeah, definitely. It's what, at the end of the day, I think anyone who does anything ultra-based, that the most important bit is experience. Yeah, and the only way to get experience is by doing them.
And it gives you it gives you confidence to be able to say, well, you know you're going to finish it, and it's, you know what to do in certain circumstances. And especially like that last night was all about experience for me. It was about how far can I ride without any sleep. Mm-hmm. So I think I rode through two nights, but then I got to a point where I was like, gonna start, like, I think I was hallucinating at one point, and I like the road, I was speaking to Rich Roll, Rich was there, and he was saying about how the road was breathing, and I was like, oh, I had the same thing, and some lights in the distance, I was like, is that a train? So I was like, okay, I found like a pavement, slept for like 20 minutes, and I had like 50k left, and I was like, oh, I've got plenty of energy now. Had one sachet left of energy powder, and I downed it and just was, I'm off. And I was happy with the performance.
It's also knowing when is the right time to not overdo it, which, as you said, stopping and having that sleep, you know, understanding that I'm a big believer that the moment I don't feel safe, that is when I will stop. That can be, you know, for example, in like Badlands, a lot of it with Badlands for me was like, the moment I thought I was doing more damage to the injury that I had already started with was when I needed to stop, whether that was sleep or rest or just walk or whatever it was. And, you know, I mean, I was, to be honest, probably doing that race injured was maybe not the wisest decision, but it also meant that I went into it going, I'm actually going to try and enjoy this and enjoy the experience.
And you did well. Like at the end of the day, it was, you know, you
still
had a great time. So, yeah. And you finished. Yeah, yeah. And you had what did you have at the end? Massive ice cream?
Or was that? Massive ice cream. Matt Faulkner bought me a massive ice cream and a beer, which is hilarious because I don't drink. So I had one beer and I was smashed. But yeah, there's like, You know, understanding your body, your limits, and the situation you're in, I think is so important. I think a lot of people don't. That only comes with experience at the end of the day. And I really do think a big bit of it as well is a lot of people, when they do their first like editions of the first time they do it, people go all guns blazing. I have to finish. I have to go as fast as possible. But there's no harm in accepting that you might have to pull out the race, or you might have to, you know, go a bit slower than you want to. There's the only thing that you're getting effectively is your own pride and ego. Like and this sounds really harsh. No one else really gives a flying fuck.
Yeah.
It's only you that really cares. And when you start to understand that that's the situation, that it is you personally that cares about it, not everyone else, that you are, for me anyway, it was quite eye-opening, because it sort of meant me kind of go, okay, I can relax. I can go there and to enjoy the race, or I can, you know, sort of take the gas off a bit. It definitely changed my sort of attitude for quite a lot of racing and long distance stuff, because you're realistically racing yourself, not anyone else.
Yeah. And like these races, to be honest, I kick myself. I don't take enough photos, yeah. But I like the idea of basically not looking, just switching off. For me, it's like an escape from like just everyday life, yeah. And just having, and just going out and just kind of, I don't know, it's a bit of me time really, and challenging myself. Like I looked at the tracker a bit more this time, because maybe I felt a bit more competitive, but at the same time I didn't look at it a lot. And so for me it's just like, well, I'll just ride and I'll do the best I can, and then at the end we'll see where I am, and I'll see where I'll get to the last night and I'll see where I am, kind of thing.
Amazing. That's, I think, is a very, very good way to sum it up. Thank you, Adam. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. I'm very excited to see how Trans-Siberia goes. I have to always get it right. I get so confused with the races.
Trans-Pyrenees. Yeah, yeah. Right. No. Trans-Siberica is like their like long distance road event. And this one's, well, they're all long distance, but I mean, they're like...
Oh, yeah.
Longer. Yeah, exactly. When's your, because you obviously pulled out of your first kind of big, how do you say that?
Garangaroosh, I think it is.
Garangaroosh, okay.
Yeah, I had to pull out of that because unfortunately, so at Garangaroosh, I had COVID, and my first, the day that I was due to fly, I was still testing positive. And I, basically my stance was like, even if I was due to fly like 3 or 4 days before it was going to start anyway. And I was like, look, even if I'm testing negative closer to the start of the race, I'm like, COVID fucked me. Like really, I was very, very unwell. And there's no way I'd have been able to have done it. Like if I would have got round, but it would not have been good. It would have been.
And also the long-term kind of impacts of COVID, and like how it would have, you know, they're really saying that how you should, after COVID, really take it easy, because otherwise, you know, you're going to really mess your body up, basically.
Exactly. And yeah, so unfortunately I pulled out of that one. This year for me, I've got a couple of charity projects, which I'm kind of, I guess, more focusing on, which I will tell you off the podcast, because I haven't announced them yet, very kind of intentionally, because I don't like publicly saying them until closer to them, although one is next month, so that's kind of close. But the, you know, there's two kind of charity projects, and then towards the latter end of the year, in theory, I should be doing Trans-Pyrenees, the TCR one,
yeah,
which I entered in 2019, so... There's a lot, really.
Yeah, I've met a lot of people that said they're doing TCR, but it's like, oh fuck, after 3 years I might actually do it.
Yeah. So there's that one, the Trans-Pyrenees, and then Garangaroosh. Matt, who's the organizer, has very kindly allowed me to transfer my entry to the next edition, whether I do the road, mountain bike, or gravel one, because ironically I'd originally signed up to do the mountain bike one, which was in November last year, but me being the numpty that I am, did not realize I was at a wedding when it was on. Oh. So Matt was like, oh, I'll just transfer you over to the gravel one, no problem. And then I couldn't go this time. And he was like, no problem, I'll transfer you over to the next edition. You can pick mountain bike or gravel. And then that will lead me to, that'll probably be end of the year. And then Atlas Mountain Race in February, because Atlas Mountain Race, they are putting it on this year, but it's the same time as the Trans-Pyrenees.
And okay, yeah.
So
I'm contemplating Atlas Mountain if I can get a place next year.
It's good. Yeah. Do it on a mountain bike though.
Yeah, do it on a mountain bike. I wouldn't do it on the quad. Like I wouldn't be doing it on my gravel, like small gravel bike. So it'll be a new bike this year, maybe.
There you go. For that event. Thank you very much. I'm going to stop the recording now, and I'm going to tell you some other stuff off the thing.